So it's a buyer's market. So I got this tape deck, and a tape deck is essentially a robot of sorts. It does what it's programmed to do. You stick a tape in, you press play, it does what it's supposed to do unless something malfunctions. And so, what would you say if I said, I'm really too busy to give the shiur tonight because I have to do hachnasas orchim. I need to oil my new tape deck and take care of it and make sure that it's well nourished and make sure that it's sitting comfortably on the shelf or whatever it is that I would do to it. Say like, what? That's not hachnasas orchim. How can that be hachnasas orchim? It's a tape deck, right? So in fact, the hachnasas orchim of last week's parsha that Avram displays to the malachim is really no different. He's running around and he's preparing meals for malachim that don't need meals, they don't need food.
But he didn't know.
So the answer that most people would say right off the bat is, well, he didn't know that they were malachim. And so therefore, his intention was to do an act of achnasas orchim, and we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu counts our positive intentions, HaKadosh Baruch Hu counts as if we've actually fulfilled them, which makes a lot of sense. After all, ultimately, we can't always control the things that are going on in the world around us. We can, at the end of the day, only really control. The only control we have is inside our own heads, right? Like Yiras Hashem is the only thing, right? The only thing a person can really control is Yiras Hashem, says the Gemara, right? Like how we approach things, how we approach life, how we deal with situations. We can't necessarily control the situation itself. And so Avram Avinu decides he wants to do Achnasas Orchim, and he's waiting and he's hoping for Achnasas, the opportunity, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends him this opportunity. Okay, it's not a real opportunity, but Avram doesn't know the difference. So it counts as a wonderful mitzvah, Achnasas Orchim. And in fact, we learn out many of the ideas of Achnasas Orchim from this event. And primarily, one of the main things we learn is that you're allowed to interrupt a conversation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in order to perform the mitzvah of Achnasas Orchim, which is what Avram Avinu did. It just seems funny, and it's something that I've been having a hard time getting past, to think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu couldn't arrange for some real people to come so that Avram could have the real mitzvah. I mean, why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu set this up in a way that it's a trick, in a sense, to Avram Avinu? They had to come anyway, but they could have come as malachim. Avram certainly had the capacity to recognize a malach and to know a malach when he saw one. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have allowed him to recognize they were malachim. He could have sent them some genuine human beings to prepare food for. Right? It's really a very surprising way, and it's even surprising that we can learn halachos. Somebody told me in Shir today. I was talking about this a little bit in Shir today in yeshiva. Somebody told me that the Lubavitcher Rebbe actually asked this question and has a whole sicha on explaining how it could possibly be that we could learn out halachos from a charade. Because it's a real question. There are answers to the question, but it's a real question, a question that has to be asked. In researching this and in looking into this, I discovered, and I'm saying the following idea, fully aware that I don't know enough about it to discuss it with full intelligence, and therefore I'm a little bit hesitant to say it, but I think it's important to hear nonetheless. And Bez Hashem, I'll try to do the research so that I can report on it more fully in a more informed way. But in fact, this idea that there's something going on that's not so real but still has significance in the world is taken to an extreme in last week's parsha by the Rambam. Again, I did not see this inside, but I heard it quoted that the Rambam, apparently in Mor Nevuchim, because Rambam doesn't have a parish directly on Chumash, but the Rambam apparently in Mor Nevuchim learns on Parshas Vayera, he has a problem with Parshas Vayera, because the parsha starts with Vayera, that Hashem appeared to Avraham. Vayera Elov Hashem Be'ilonei Mamre V'hu Yoshev Pesach O'er Kachom Hayom. There's an introductory pasuk to last week's parsha that Hashem appeared to Avraham. And then there's no mention of what took place between them right away. It says, Vayisa Einav Vayar, he lifted his eyes and he saw that there were three people approaching, and he went and he prepared and gets into the whole thing. So the Rashi and Midrashim help us understand what happened, that he was actually having a conversation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to be Mevaker Chola. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was he interrupted this bikur, and that's where we learned this din that you're allowed to interrupt talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to go do achnasas zochim. But even that is so hard to understand. I mean, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to do the mitzvah of achnasas of bikur cholim. I mean, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need the mitzvah of bikur cholim, first of all, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have to have Avram being a chola, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu could say, well, you know, he could do the bismillah, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu could make it that he shouldn't be suffering and that he shouldn't, right? After all, where does his strength come from? So it almost seems like the whole thing is a charade from the beginning. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is coming to play this role of, like, you know, coming to sit by the side of the sick person in bed and play the role of the mevaker chola, while the chola is actually the only one who seems to be here really feeling something that's real. While this charade is being played out, HaKadosh Baruch Hu causes another charade to be played out, that he sees these three malachim who he thinks are human beings and he can perform a mitzvah with, who are not in fact human beings, not what they appear to be, and he goes ahead and he does this whole, so the whole thing is kind of a charade, and it's introduced in this very problematic way by and almost like an esoteric way, where you really have to have the medrash to fill in the gaps. I mean, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu appear? What was he doing? What were they talking about? Did they have a conversation? Was it just an appearance? Like, what's going on over here? There's no ending to that beginning. That's an introductory sentence. You would expect to find some sort of explanation, and there is none. Because of all of this, apparently the Rambam, as I said, I have to see this inside, but apparently the Rambam, as I heard it quoted, learns that at least this first story, and possibly, I don't know, I may have heard the quote wrong, so don't hold me to this, but possibly all of the Parsha was in fact a vision, was in fact something that took place only in Avraham Avinu's mind. That's why I say, but that's what, no, the bris happened already in the Parsha before, right? Not the bris milah, but the events that took place after this bris milah. So what about Sodom? There's a lot of questions. That's why I say I haven't seen it inside. All day today I was saying I have to go look in the, I have a Morna Vuchim sitting right by my desk ready to look into it. I didn't get the time to look it up. So I don't know to what extent the Rambam takes it. I do know that the quote about the Rambam was followed by a quote from the Ramban, who disagrees in the strongest of language with the Rambam on this idea, and says that, you know, I don't remember the exact language, but that, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about, and it's crazy to suggest that all of this is some sort of a vision. However, I think whether it is or it isn't, I'm not suggesting this to say that this is the pshat and this is actually what happened, because certainly most Rishonim do not learn that way, and most Mefarshim do not learn that way, and it's a very problematic way. But there is a limud that can come out of that way of looking at the parsha, and I think it's worth knowing about this for that reason, because let's just assume for the moment that the Rambam is correct, right? It's hard for us to, especially we grow up in yeshiva, we learn the Torah, we know that there are things in the Torah that can be allegorical, but most things in the Torah itself are not. As a matter of fact, we once discussed in Sefer Yoshua a very beautiful idea that the Rambam says that in Yemos HaMashiach, that all the psukim that talk about the wolf lying with the lamb and the leopard with the goat, and that there'll be changes, so to speak, in the nature of the world, those are all allegorical. He says it's all a mashal, it's all allegory. In fact, the allegory is to the Jewish people and the nations, that the Jewish people are considered like the domesticated animals, so to speak, and the nations are the wild, ferocious animals, and the idea is that in the Yemos HaMashiach, there's going to be the ability for the wolf to lie with the lamb. Is the pshat that we'll be able to sit down, and the Rambam uses lashon, we'll be able to sit down and eat food that's kosher and kedasu kedin together with non-Jews in absolute peace and harmony, and that's what's going to change. But the fundamental physics and nature of the world is not going to change. So the Rambam says that, and the Ravid, who is who wrote a parish on the Rambam, where he constantly is asking a lot of questions on the Rambam, challenging the Rambam a number of things. So the Ravid asks a question on this and says, how could you, Rambam, say that all of this is allegory? We have a pasuk in the Torah that says, Vishbati chayorah min ha'aretz, that the chayara, that the wild animals, right, the bad, the dangerous animals are going to be, they're going to leave the land, right? They're no longer going to be here. So how could you say that it's all allegory? So we asked a question on that Ravid. I don't know if anyone remembers, right? I think probably you were the only one that was there. We asked a question on the Ravid. Ruchi might have been there, and Beverly was probably there also. We asked a question on the Ravid. What kind of question is that? The Rambam brings a number of psukim, and the Rambam says that these psukim are all meant to be allegorical. Comes the Ravid and says, but I have a pasuk that says another thing that is going to change in the Yemos HaMashiach. So why is that a question? The Rambam will say, okay, that's also allegorical. Right? The Rambam just finished explaining that all the psukim that talk about these fantastic things happening in Yemos HaMashiach are meant to be allegory, and that actually nothing is fundamentally going to change in the world. Along comes the Ravid and says, but I have another pasuk that you didn't happen to mention that says the same kind of a thing. How are you going to deal with that? So what do you mean, how am I going to deal with that? I'll say it's an allegory, right? So at the time, we saw a very beautiful explanation of this given, I think, by the Brisker Rav, if I'm not mistaken. It's one of the Soloveitchiks. And he says, no, the pshat is that the Rambam brought psukim from Nach, from Nevi'im and Ksuvim. The Rambam brought psukim from the other books of the Torah, not the five books of Moshe. So when the Ravid is asking a question, the Ravid is asking, and you look at the Ravid's language, he specifically says, V'alo kasuv batorah, it says in the Torah, meaning the Chamishu Chumshei Torah, V'shbati chayra min ha'aretz. So what the Ravid's question really is, you, Rambam, are saying that the psukim in Nevi'im and Ksuvim are not meant to be taken literally, they're meant to be taken as allegorical, and therefore all the things that are going to happen in Musa Mashiach that are discussed in Nevi'im Ksuvim, in the Nevu'ah that we have in those Sefarim, that's all meant to be allegorical. Okay, I could maybe live with that. But here we have a pasuk in the Torah itself that is saying that the Chayara, Hishbati Chayara in Aretz, is not going to be Chayara in the land. How could you say it's all allegorical? You certainly can't say that a pasuk in the Torah is allegorical. Because in fact, the Torah we know was given by Moshe Rabbeinu, was given by Kodesh Baruch Hu to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, we've discussed many times, had what is called the Aspaklaria HaMe'ira. He had the very clear lens that allowed him to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Nevuah with absolute clarity. We also talked about at the time, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu is the only Navi, with one exception, but he's the only Navi about which it is said, Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe Lemar. The language Lemar is only used about Moshe. There are actually a few exceptions, I'll say it. But consistently in the Torah, Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Lemar, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe Lemar, Lemar, Lemar. What's Lemar? So if you look at the first Lemar in the Torah, the first Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe Lemar in the Torah occurs in Sefer Shmos. I believe it's Perek Vav Pasuk Yud. I don't have a Shmos here. Well, there's one there, but I'm pretty sure it's Perek Vav Pasuk Yud. It's in Parshas Va'era. And it says, Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe Lemar. All the Mepharshim immediately scramble to speak about this word Lemar. Because the word Lemar, you don't think about it, but it's really extra. Up until that point, in all of Parshas Shmos, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu was speaking to Moshe, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was speaking to Aaron at one point when he tells Aaron to go meet Moshe, it just says, Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe, and then it starts saying what he said. Wait, one second. Yeah, you're jumping out. Right? But it doesn't feel necessary, the Torah doesn't feel necessary to say the word Lemar. Vaydaber Hashem El Moshe, and then it says, right? Lemar is like saying. That's how we, right? Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying. We don't have extra words in the Torah, so why is the Torah suddenly switching and using the word Lemar? So the Pashup Shat is that it means to say over to Klal Yisrael. That when it says Lemar, and that's what a number of the Mepharshim say, Ala Makom, on that Pasuk, they say it means to go ahead and say it over to Klal Yisrael, repeat this to Klal Yisrael. Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, meaning that you should go ahead and say it and repeat it. That's what it means. The Ramban on that Pasuk is not satisfied with those answers, because there are a number of exceptions that don't seem to fit that profile. As a matter of fact, that particular first, Vaydaber Hashem and Moshe Lemar, does not fit the profile. That is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe to go to Paro. Did Moshe have to repeat that to Klal Yisrael? Maybe yes, but it certainly wouldn't seem necessary that he had to repeat it to Klal Yisrael, because it was an instruction telling Moshe what to do. So Moshe, therefore, and then Moshe goes and carries it out. So why is there a lame there? So the Ramban comes up with an explanation as a linear, like to him it's more, it appears to be more, to make more sense to say that Lamar is a designation that applies to an absolutely crystal clear vision. He calls it an Amira Gemura. It's an emphasis on the Lamar. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe, Hashem speaks to Moshe, Lamar, with an absolutely crystal clear saying, so that Moshe, there was no question in Moshe's mind about what was being said. And so
it's clear. It's the Moshe's capacity to.
So where do we find the exceptions to the Lamar, to the Lamar being applied for Moshe? There are three exceptions. One exception is Aaron HaKohen. It says, Vayidaber Hashem el Aaron Lamar at one point in the Torah. Okay, it's the one time that Hashem speaks directly to Aaron. I don't remember exactly the parsha. And that's one exception. Okay, so we could say, look, Aaron was on a very, very high level as well. It didn't happen on a daily basis, but it could say, okay, one time HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to Aaron, he spoke to him very, very clearly. It's such a big problem. The second exception to this rule is that a number of times in Sefer Yehoshua, it says the language of Vayidaber Hashem el Yehoshua Lamar. So we could also answer that. Say Yehoshua was also on a very high level, close to Moshe Rabbeinu, as we've discussed many times in the Sefer Yehoshua Shir, and therefore you could use Lamar. But the final exception doesn't fit this profile at all. There's another person in Sefer Bereishis that Hashem speaks to with the designation of Lamar. No, not Noach. We can go through all the people in Sefer Bereishis, right? It's not any of the Avos. Not in this week's Parsha. It's not any of the Avos. It's not any. It hasn't happened yet in the Torah. It's Lavan ha'Arami, right? When Lavan, exactly, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Lavan and Lavan reports on what it is that Hashem told him to Yaakov the next day, he says, Emesh Amar Hashem li Lamor. So you say, well, Lavan got a crystal clear nevuah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I mean, it seems to be so opposite from everything that we're saying. So the Pashut Pshat answer, the very Pashut answer is, what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling him in that vision? HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling him, don't harm Yaakov, don't touch him. So it's very important that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him an absolutely crystal clear vision. Don't touch Yaakov. I don't want you to be able to have to interpret this in any way. I'm going to give you the gift of absolute nevuah so that you know, don't touch him, don't harm him in any way, don't do anything. And Lavan appreciates it that way. Not really because Lavan was, that's a good point. It's because of who Yaakov was and because of who Lavan was. And therefore, he had this dream. I mean, the Torah tells that's nevuah. Yes.
Well,
yes.
Don't forget the building it was either Lavan or one of Lavan's descendants.
Right. Bilam and Lavan. There's a connection there also. But Bilam, it doesn't say Vayidaber Hashem el Bilam Lamar.
They were both Risham Gamar.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Absolutely. So this exception to Lavan also fits with what the Ramban is saying. What's the point that I'm making with all of this? So let's go back to the original Ramban that we said about that the Vishbati Chayron. It's the Ravid S on the Rambam rather. The Ravid S. How could you say from a pasuk in the Torah that says Vishbati Chayron? So how could you say it's all allegorical? I don't know what the Rambam would answer. The Rambam doesn't answer the Ravid. The Ravid came after the Rambam, so he didn't have a chance to really answer him. But at least the Rabbi Yashaber points out that we see from this Ravid that even when he understood that a psukim in Nevi'im and Ksuvim can be somewhat ambiguous, somewhat unclear. We've spoken many times about how a Nevi'im had to interpret the Nevuah that they got through their personalities, through who they were. That's why we have a concept of Ein Shnei Nevi'im Nisnavim B'Signon Echad. No two Nevi'im ever said Nevuah with the exact same words. Because it has to go through who you are as a person, as a Navi, and different people have different personalities and different experiences and come from different places. And as a matter of fact, that's why it's so true, because even today, if you're having a conversation, so let's say you're showing somebody something, you know, you've bought a new, book or something, and you're showing it to people, and you show it to about 15, 20 people, and suddenly, like, the 18th person you show it to reacts in the exact same way as, like, the second person you showed it to. So what's your... And literally says the exact same words with the same expression. You're like, whoa, that's what so-and-so said. That's exactly what so-and-so said. Like, and you react with kind of, like, shock and amazement. Why? Because it doesn't... It rarely, rarely ever works that way. Even in real life, when we're not talking about nevuah and we're not talking about lofty concepts, just in the simple world, people don't say the exact same thing in the same way. As a child in Baltimore, there was a thing when if two of us would say the exact same thing at the same moment, I don't know, here in Baltimore they used to call it pins on you. right? The first person would say, pin's on you. The other person can't talk anymore until, I don't remember what the release was, actually. Is that what? What is it?
You have to say their name.
You have to say their name. Is that what it was? Right. I think we have a friend that still hasn't spoken ever since. But right. But it's like, you know, why is that? What kind of crazy thing is that? What pins on you? I don't know. New York must have a different way of saying it. Jinx. Jinx. I remember. Right. Jinx. Where does that come from? What does that mean? Jinx. What is it? So the idea is, it's such a surprising thing that you both said the exact same thing at the same time that it almost like begs to be noticed. Right? So, in fact, that is the case with Nevuah, that it's impossible for, since Nevuah is so deep, so profound, it's impossible that it could be interpreted in the same way by two different Nevi'im. The exception to that was, of course, Klal Yisrael at Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael Sashir Azos Leimor, right? The word Leimor. All of Klal Yisrael and Moshe Rabbeinu sang the Shira word for word together, with the absolute clarity of vision, because it was based on Nevuah, and they were all saying the exact words together, because that was the highest level of Nevuah, through Asbaklaria HaMe'ira, through the absolutely clear lens of ultimate Nevuah. But that's a rare thing, and we have a pasuk that we talked about once, that in the future, it says that the watchman will, in the days of Mashiach, it's a Nevuah in Yeshayo, I think, that in the days of Mashiach, the watchmen will sing Az Yiranenu Yachtav. They're going to sing as one. They're going to sing in unison. How are they going to sing in unison if they're singing Nevuah? The answer is the Nevuah of Yemos HaMashiach is going to be on that level of clarity that they will be able to say things exactly in the same words. But up until that point, it's not. So this, and now Avram Avinu, we mentioned last week, Avram Avinu did not get Nevuah through Asbaklaria HaMe'ira. Avram Avinu got Nevuah through Asbaklai She'ena Me'ira. Even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him, so it was a little bit of a higher level than some of the Nevi'im later on who received visions and had to interpret the visions, that's a harder thing to interpret. Avram Avinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him, and so it was much closer to the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu than the average Navi later on, but it still wasn't the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is why there is some uncertainty with the way that Avram Avinu interprets HaKadosh Baruch Hu's words. So, for example, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, Haleu Sham La'ola, bring up your son as an Ola, so there's no problem understanding that those words just mean bring up your son as an Ola. But now that leaves the question, okay, but is it just bring up your son as an Ola and stop there? Or is it bring up your son as an Ola and do everything that you would do to an Ola? And Avraham Avinu has to interpret that for himself. Right, and there's all sorts of, you know, all the Mefarshim twist and turn to try to explain what exactly happened. Did Avram Avinu, you can't really say that he made a mistake, so what happened? Did he really know that it wasn't intended? But it certainly sounds from a lot of Mefarshim like he really thought it was going to happen, and there's a lot of, that's a discussion that takes a little bit of a different direction. But my point here is that there's an idea that it's not the clear language, the clear vision of Moshe Rabbeinu Vaspaklaya HaMe'ira when HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears and speaks to Avram Avinu.
Can I just say one thing? Usually you think of it when Am Yisrael was in Har Sinai, it says B'lei V'chad.
Right.
So usually you think of the Aptos brought the Nevuah, but from what you just said,
oh, absolutely.
It sounds like the Nevuah.
Absolutely. Many. Sure, absolutely. But there was, well, at Har Sinai, we believe really it worked both ways. Klal Yisrael kind of had to get on the same page, but really, it was a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to really get to that level, to be able to hear HaKadosh Baruch Hu speak to them directly after coming out of Mitzrayim. So, 7 weeks before is really not realistic. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them a tremendous boost and raised them up. And Enochinami, that's why we talked about a number of times, that's why their neshamas had to leave their guf. Their neshamas couldn't stay in their bodies because of two reasons, two ways of looking at it. One way of looking at it is, it's a very interesting idea. One way of looking at it is that the neshamos of Klal Yisrael were so united by being so much on the same page and receiving the same nevuah, besignon echad, literally, that their individuality could not be maintained. And so just as a flame of a candle, right, when you hold several candles together, the flames will jump and make one flame. The flame of a candle is compared in the deeper svarim to the neshama for a number of levels. So too, neshamos, when they get so close, when they're so a single-mindedly of purpose. They like so much on the same page. So they leaped out of their bodies. They couldn't maintain an individuality. They became the neshama of Klal Yisrael. That's one way of understanding it. That's based on the Shem Shmuel. The Babich Rebbe says something similar to that. And I believe I first heard it brought, the idea brought down by Rivers Real Tauber. Another idea, though, that the Meshech Chachma says in his introduction to Sefer Shemos, the Meshech Chachma says that the idea is that because they received this high level of Nevuah, this intense level of Nevuah, that allowed them to perceive the word of Hashem with absolute clarity, when a person gets to that level, they are beyond Bechira, they're beyond making a choice. When a person experiences Hashem with such brilliant clarity, so there's no possibility of doing anything other than following the word of Hashem, because that person has risen above the possibility of any type of... I mean, after all, what holds us back from doing the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Our physicality, our intellect, right? We think about things and we analyze things, and is this right, is that right? The fact that we're stuck here in a world that's after the chet of Adam HaRishon, who ate from the Eitz Ladas Tov Vara, of the tree of good and bad, which took us out of a world of emes and sheker, out of a world where there was a certain clarity, into a world of cloudiness. What's cloudiness? It means it's no longer objective, it's subjective. And it's subjective to good and bad. Good and bad. What's good for me might not be good for you. What's bad for me might be good for you. It could, right? Different things for different people. But when you get to the level of hearing the word of Hashem and recognizing the reality of the Bria, the reality of creation, that it really all is Hashem, it's kind of getting beyond the physical mask, right, of creation, to see creation as it truly is, which is part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So at that moment, it's not possible for so he says like this, Mashiach says so beautifully, he says, when Hashem spoke to Moshe on that level, where did he do it? He did it by the Ohel Moed. Right outside the Ohel Moed, the idea was that everybody should be able to see, but there could have been many places where he could have done it, where everybody could. Why the Ohel Moed? Because the Ohel Moed is the place in this existence, the physical space in this existence, that the Shekhinah resides. So the Meshech Chachma says, so too, the guf, the body, is the physical place in this existence that the neshama resides. So when the neshama gets to the point that it recognizes, when the person gets to the point that recognizes that the physical dwelling place isn't really anything, it's just a mask, it's just a facade, it's just something that's not real, so then there's no longer a need for a place to reside, and there isn't a place to reside, because the place to reside has suddenly become part and parcel of the neshama. Right? There's no longer a differentiation between the neshama and the body. The body has been, when a human being has such an experience of seeing the clarity of the world as it truly is, then that human being, therefore there is no, it's like, I mean, there's really no better example for the modern mind to understand this. There's a film, I hesitate to talk about it, but it's, I can't think of a better way of explaining it. There's a film called The Matrix. And the idea of the film is that these people understand and discover that the world is not really as it seems, but really it's a fake world that's a construct by these machines. The plot of the movie isn't important, but what is important is the idea that there are certain people who are able to get beyond it and see the world as it really is, which is like this very sophisticated computer program. So Lahavdil, Alfa Avdalos, what we're saying over here is that the world isn't really anything other than a manifestation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It appears to us that this is a shtender, and that those are chairs, and that I'm me, and you're you, and this is all the way that we experience things. But really, we know that it's not that at all. It's all really the light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's filtered through different filters so that it seems to us that this is the world that we live in. Right? When a person gets to a point where they can experience the world as it truly is, so then there's no possibility of separation. It's not a guf and a neshama anymore. So the guf is kind of the guf is the same thing as the neshama in a sense. So therefore, there are neshamos left in a sense of their bodies when Hashem spoke to them, and they realized, oh, this is all a mask. This is all a facade. This is all a charade. So the reaction was, it was not like a punishment, and it's not even like a constant. It's just the normal. The next step is It's a right. It's not a punishment. It's a consequence. The consequence of that is that there's no longer such thing as a person being different than another person, or a difference between any of us, right? So therefore, there are neshamos left. That's what the Meshech Chachma says.
Because after the chet, and they were all, because Hashem already raised them to the level before the chet. In order for them to get to that level, they had experience.
Okay, but that's a different angle. But the Mesh, I hear that. Yeah, the Meshech Chachma says that Moshe Rabbeinu actually had achieved this level. He doesn't say it, but I was thinking that might be one of the reasons why how we would explain the fact that his face was shining, because his guf was purified completely. His guf and his neshama really were on the same exact level.
But that's different than Am Yisrael.
Am Yisrael didn't stay there.
They became like one.
Right. Am Yisrael didn't stay there. Okay. Right. Yeah.
Remember you talked about in Yeshua.
Right,
so he didn't have to go through that experience because he was on a higher level.
Right. He had already reached that level, and his level, the level he was already at Har Sinai, the Meshech Chachma describes as being a level that's beyond Bechira. Moshe Rabbeinu did not have Bechira, right? This is kind of fundamental to our belief in the Torah. Why do we know that Moshe Rabbeinu, right? It says, "B'cha yaminu la'olam," says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that they're going to believe in you, Moshe, forever. So how could Hashem say that? In fact, maybe Moshe would, add something to the Torah later on. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows the future, so he knows he's not going to, but if Moshe has Bechira, so then he has to be able to make choices. But the answer, Meshech Chachma says, it's his Chiddush, but it's a beautiful way of looking at it. Moshe really didn't have Bechira. Why didn't he have Bechira? Bechira is only when I have a choice to make, should I do X or should I do Y? But the only reason I have such choices is because I'm not sure what's good and what's bad, and because I have the physicality of my existence to be a part of that choice. But if I'm beyond that, I don't have any choices. And Moshe Rabbeinu had to be that way in order to give the Torah in a way that we could be absolutely sure would be pure. That's a good question, and that deserves a discussion. But we're not going with that. It's an excellent question, but we have to understand that. So in any case, so what's coming out of all of this is, this sounds like we're very far away from Parshas Chayesara, certainly, but also from Vayera. But what's coming out of all of this is that I was thinking that you can see that the Rambam's understanding of Parshas Vayera actually has significance. Whether we agree that that's actually real pshat, that it was just a vision or not, is not important. But the way of looking at it like that teaches us something very, very important, and that is, let's say the Rambam is correct. Let's say his pshat is correct. Let's just take that for it's hard for anyone who grew up, thinking of these in according to Rashi and according to the Ramban and according to Ibn Ezra and all the other Mefarshim. But let's just for a moment imagine that really it was all a vision. So our question is, if it's all a vision, what's its value? So now we can say, after talking about this and explaining what it means, what is a charade, all of existence is a charade. So it's possible to say that even according to the Rambam, who says that the whole thing is some sort of a charade, some sort of a vision where Avram doesn't actually do these things, why are they significant? Because in fact, there really is no difference between a charade that Avram would play out in his vision, in his dreams, and in real life. There's no difference whatsoever, right? And sending malachim no longer becomes a problem because Avram would say, oh, he tricked Avram Avinu. Well, there's no difference between sending malachim and human beings. As long as Avram believes that they're human beings. It's not just the pshat that as long as he thought he was doing a good thing, so we'll count it as a good thing. There's actually no difference, because human beings are really no different than malachim either, except for the fact that they have bechira. But in terms of them being, so if HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes three human beings and he directs them to pass by Avram's house and he sends them to Avram Avinu, which they didn't do by their own bechira, right? So why didn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu send him three Arabs, three locals, you know? So the answer is because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends those three locals, so it's really no different than sending the Malachim. But if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who's doing the sending, so they're not making acts of Bechira. If they're not making acts of Bechira, then they're not acting as human beings, right? Our fundamental identity is the fact that we make choices, is the fact that we have Bechira. So therefore, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu once again you know, messing around in his charade and manipulating in the play. Yeah, so there's nothing to be gained by sending human beings, right? Once we understand that the world is all HaKadosh Baruch Hu's charade, so there's nothing to be gained by sending human beings. Malachim serve the same purpose as human beings, as long as Avram believes that he's doing real Hachnasas Orchim. And in fact, if you look at the parasha according to the Rambam, or everything, even if, again, I'm not saying the Rambam says the Akedah is all allegorical, is all a vision, but let's say that he would say it. So it doesn't change anything, and the Rambam would have to say that it doesn't change. It doesn't take away one iota from the value of the Akedah, from the value of everything that happens in the parsha, because in fact, since all of the world is a facade, a charade, and so on and so forth. So if it happens in a vision, but it happens with sincerity and it happens from a place of Bechira that Avram believes that he's making these choices, so it's exactly the same thing as if he was really making the choices. So the whole idea of whether it is a vision or not a vision seems to fall away. And what we can see from this, I believe, is a little bit of a different approach to what was being accomplished. I think this opens up a little bit of a portal into what was really being accomplished by the events that took place in Vayera and the events that continue to take place in Chayasar. We spoke the last couple of weeks about the transition that has to take place in Avram Avinu, who is the Avram. He's the ultimate father, in the sense that he's the ultimate father of the Jewish people and the world, but also in the sense that he's the ultimate father of all the other fathers, meaning of Yitzchak and Yaakov. He's the primary father. So Avram Avinu starts as he's the Av of Chesed. Chesed means kindness, loving kindness, giving. The Zohar describes the chesed of Avram as being like water, because water is giving and malleable and gives life and so on and so forth. And the pure chesed we discussed can be a very, very terrible thing, just as water can also destroy, can be a horrible destroyer. Because pure chesed, giving without boundaries, is very, very problematic for both the person who's giving and the person who's receiving. Very, very problematic. So the chesed has to be tempered. Avram has to go on a journey, lech lecha. He has to go and develop himself from being an ish who has absolute chesed. He's the paradigm of chesed. And he has to become the father of din, the father of Yitzchak, who's din. Din is the opposite. Din, says the Zohar, is fire. And din is the idea of fire can be consuming and it's also restrictive and it's holding back, right? I mean, fire is a whole different thing than water. So Avram has to, in order to give birth, so to speak, to a son to be the Av of Din, which is required for the world, because you can't have pure chesed, you can't have din, you have to have a combination of the two. So Avram is on a journey where he's really moving from chesed all the way to din. And that's what we saw in last week's parsha, that at the beginning of the parsha, Avram is doing all this chesed, he's running around preparing all the meals for the malachim. And at the end of the parsha, he's standing over his son with a knife, begging HaKadosh Baruch Hu to please at least let me make a cut, at least let me do something, right? He's moved tremendously from water and from chesed and from running around to do Achlas Zorchim to a place of din where he wants to carry out the exact words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is a learning process that has taken place over the course of the parsha. And it's a process that brings Yitzchak into the world as the Av of Din. But it's he's the Av of Din who really is coming from chesed. Right, it's not just, I mean, he's the balance to chesed, but he was produced by Avram Avinu, who is chesed. Okay, now with that understanding, so we can say that
Sarah is born,
has
a lot of din in her
belly. So let's talk about Sarah a little bit.
Right. Why is this, if the whole world anyway, is everything is a charade, so why is it, or an illusion, so why do we need the specific to be an illusion of the illusion? So what's the point?
That's exactly the point I'm making.
About this illusion, right. There needs to be an illusion of the rest of the illusion.
Excellent question. That exactly is the point that I'm trying to make. I'm glad you asked it, because now I can say it more clearly. And that is that it reveals to us that it's an illusion. In other words...
Okay, but why this specific incident?
Because here you have a case where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is clear. And as Hashem wants to teach us that it's all an illusion, right? And He wants to teach it to us in a way that we'll understand it. So it's possible, I'm just suggesting, it's possible to say that He's teaching us this because he's personally involved. We don't have that many cases where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Moshe, it's primarily about Torah, it's about bringing Nisim and so on. Here's a case where HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and he pays, he's Mevaker Chola, right? Imagine yourself, he's Mevaker Chola. So you say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Mevaker Chola, he has to be Mevaker Chola. The answer is, yeah. And then he sends the Malachim. So he's showing by this charade that the actions that you take, even if you learn according to the Ramban and all the Mepharshim that they were really Malachim, that the whole thing really happened, but the fact that we learn from this, the fact that we learn halachos from this, teaches us that that it's all a charade, but it still counts. Right? Don't think it doesn't count just because it's a charade. Sometimes there are people who will say, and this is actually in the film, there was one way of looking at it. Well, if it's all charade, so then nothing really matters, and I may as well just give in to the charade and just go along with it, right? The idea is that the Torah is teaching us, no, it could be a charade. Avraham Avinu could be doing mitzvahs that aren't even really mitzvahs because they're not really human beings that are worthy of hachnasas orachim, yet it counts to the extent that right now, if I have to daven, and there's a poor person at my door who needs a meal, I'm allowed to interrupt my davening to give that poor person a meal, to be machnisar, right? To do achnas asarchim. I have an actual, real-world halacha that comes out of a charade, which teaches us that although the whole thing is a charade, it still counts, and it has meaning, and it's significant. Exactly,
maybe,
yes.
So maybe it's this particular partial incident, because really, by Hashem visiting Abraham and by him sending Malachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu here is being revealed. It's not like he's working
right
through.
Exactly. He's revealing that. Exactly. That's exactly the case. Right. Exactly.
I'm visiting you and I'm sending
exactly. And that's why it's Bayera Elav Hashem, Be'lone Mamre. And it doesn't explain it because the explanation is the whole rest of the parsha. The whole rest of the parsha is a revelation of Hashem as being really what the world is all about. So listen to this. So now, what is one of the main themes in producing Yitzchak? The main theme in producing Yitzchak is laughter, right? Because after all, in Parshas Lech Lecha, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Avram Avinu about that he's going to have a child, what's Avram's response? He laughs. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Sarah through the Malach that she's going to have a son, what's her response? She laughs. Now, of course, when a man laughs, it's okay. When a woman laughs, it's not okay, right? Okay, I know there's a lot of I'm being silly, right? There's obviously that's not what it's about, but and there are many pshatim on it, but clearly you see that laughter plays a huge role, so much so that the name of the Av who personifies Din, which you think of as being restrictive and harsh, is Yitzchak, is laughter. So what is the pshat in this laughter? And how does this fit into everything that we're talking about? And how would that bring us to Chayei Sarah, which we're not going to really get into. We don't have time to get into it, but at least we'll be an introduction to the parsha. It works as follows.
What are you
going to
catch up?
I don't know. I have to skip something. It works as follows. Listen to this amazing thing. What is laughter on a very deep level? There was a case a number of years ago. I should say this, I say it every week lately, but a lot of this is based on the Torah of my cousin, Rav Matthias Weinberg, the son of Rav Yaakov Weinberg, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Neri Yisrael. And he actually brought this example, which I think is a wonderful example. A number of cases, you know, there's a organization, I don't know if it's a very big organization, but they make it their business to infiltrate meetings of world leaders. And their whole thing is to get somebody close enough to the president or the prime minister or the leader of some country and get a pie in his face or her face. That's the whole focus of the organization, right? Some people have, you know, very important goals in life and very important things. And that they believe they're making a very strong political statement and so on and so forth. So a number of years ago, this happened to the Prime Minister of Canada. I don't remember who it was at the time. It happened to the Prime Minister of Canada. And you have to realize, if you're a world leader and you're in a public place, there's television cameras and so on, and you get a pie in your face, that's a pretty, you know, a pretty important moment. And how you react to that moment is going to be really important. So in fact, this Prime Minister reacted by getting really angry and like ranting and raving and just like, you know, like chutzpah and so on, and he made some sort of ridiculous comment like, you know, people like that should be executed or something, you know, some very over-the-top comment. And he lost tremendous public relations points because of that incident. What would the alternative response be to getting a pie in the face? The alternative response would be to taste it and say, oh, pretty good, right? Especially if you're on camera, right? If you did that, you're like, pretty good. maybe could use a little more sugar or whatever, you know, something like that. That would be considered to be a person who didn't lose their balance. They were able to deal with it in a healthy way, and that person's poll ratings would skyrocket, because that's kind of to be able to hold your own and keep your cool and react in that way and come out with a good one-liner. That's really something. Why is that so significant? Why do the polls react? Why do people react so strongly to this? Because in fact, a pie in the face, and really this is telling us something about the fundamental essence of laughter, a pie in the face is basically what is in theory funny about it. Now, nowadays, we don't even find it so funny. Nowadays, somebody once gave me some classic film from the Marx Brothers, and I wanted to laugh, and there were actually some funny moments, but most of the slapstick, just I didn't find that funny. Okay, so our tastes changed, but what's the fundamental idea? Why is a pie in the face funny at all? Why does that have any significance? Because unexpected. And what it does is, you're a prime minister and you're here at this important world meeting of the G8 or whatever it is, and you're making these decisions that are going to affect millions and millions of people, a pie in the face kind of like brings you back to reality, the fact that you're no different than anyone else. That's really what it's saying. You're no different than anyone else. And I could actually understand why somebody would have such an organization. I do have better things to do with my life. But it's not really harming anyone. And to the idea of bringing world leaders back to their senses, to have them recognize that they're just a human being like anyone else, not a bad aspiration in life, right? So, right, it's taking away their illusion of who they are and what their importance is and so on and so forth. So how a person reacts to that actually tells you a lot about the person. Because if the person reacts and gets angry and has a real problem with it, so that tells you that the person is taking their view of reality way too seriously, right? If a person reacts by coming up with a good one-liner, tasting the cake and making a joke out of it, that tells you that this person is kind of standing ready to change their view of their reality at any moment. When something happens, they don't take themselves so seriously, and they'll take their vision of the world. Because after all, and this is very, very true in life, we do create our own reality. We create our reality based on our state of mind, based on the way that we think about things. We create our state of reality. So a person has the ability to change their state of reality, but only when the way that they're thinking about their reality, the way they create their state of reality, is not too serious, is not rooted in this idea that it is the only vision of reality. In order for a person to be able to flow with events, they have to have a view of reality that accepts that their view of reality is only one of several possible views. And that, therefore, when something happens that's different, when something happens that shakes their view of reality that they're currently holding, they can let go of that view of reality and immediately shift to another one, because the events that took place that were out of their control have showed them that they need to adjust their view of reality. That is what laughter is about. Laughter, what is laughter? We think of laughter as a release, right? When somebody laughs, it's like a release. Sometimes there's a good comic, and nowadays there aren't that many who can do comedy without resorting to lowbrow humor. But a good comic is somebody who kind of builds something. He builds some sort of a view of reality. He tells a little story, builds a view of reality, and suddenly there's a line that causes it to be upended, right? It comes completely. Like there's a famous piece of comedy with where the guy is imitating he's talking about cigarette smoking, and he says that he imagines the first phone call. Of course, there wasn't phones. He imagines the first phone call between Sir Walter Raleigh and the British company that he used to work for back in the British. And he says that he's sending them a whole boatload of leaves back to London. And the whole routine is based on the guy in London talking to Sir Walter Raleigh. Saying, "You're sending us a boatload of leaves? What do we have plenty of leaves here, you know, in the fall. Like, we don't." And there's like a whole thing. And he's like, "Oh, it's a different kind of leaf. What do you do with it?" And he's like, "Oh, you can grind it up, and you stick it up your nose, and it makes you sneeze." Like, ha ha ha! Like, yeah, of course, you know. And cause what he's doing is he's taking a view of reality that where we understand what tobacco is and what it does, and he's upending it in a sense. He's showing how, from another perspective, from another view of reality, it's completely ridiculous. Oh, you roll it up and you set fire to it, and you breathe in the smoke. Right? He says, you could do that by standing in front of your fireplace, you know? Like, that. he's just, and but that is what humor is.
Like an objective, isn't it? Like stepping back.
It's exactly. And what happens is when we have the opportunity to let go of our view of reality, that causes a release, because holding on to a vision of reality takes emotional energy. It takes our energy. We don't realize it. We don't think about it. But to hold on to our view of reality, it takes a certain amount of emotional energy. When we're able to suddenly get a little bit of a different view, it causes a feeling of release, which causes laughter. So on a very deep fundamental level, laughter represents the possibility of a human being to create their reality but to create their reality in a way that they're ready to change at a moment as a result of circumstances that are beyond their control.
And to let go of their illusions.
And to let go of their illusions, exactly. So that's really what happens to Avram and Yitzchak. For the shift from Avram to Yitzchak is a shift from Chesed to Din. It's a shift. What is din? Din is judgment. To judge something, you put it on a scale and you weigh it, right? That's the classic view of judgment. So chesed and agvura, right? So there's this balance that is required. In order for a person to live a healthy life, it's required to have a balance. You have to have a balance of chesed, of giving, of loving kindness, and so on and so forth. You have to have a balance of having boundaries. Boundaries are extremely important, right? We talked about how Sodom last week. We talked about how Sodom is a country that didn't believe in there being any type of help for another person, because if you help another person, you're killing that person, you're hurting that person, because they should be able to develop themselves, right? So if you help someone when they should be able to do it themselves, you're crossing a boundary, and that's why when they surrounded the house, Lot's house, and they demanded that they send out the malachim, not knowing they were malachim, of course, they said that they were going to rape them. That's a so bizarre. Like, I actually was talking about it in yeshiva, and there were a number of guys that are 19, 20 years old who had only learned Chumash, I guess, in elementary school, and they're like, what? I said, have you read the Parsha lately? You know? That's what the Mefarshim say. That's what they're asking. So it always seems so bizarre. That's what they're asking? What kind of crazy country is this? They're, you have guests, so send them out here? It's insanity. It doesn't even make sense. But on a certain level, now we can say it makes sense. It's still horrible, of course. They were destroyed for a reason. I'm not defending it in any way, shape, or form. But it makes a certain level of sense. Like, if you're hurting them, you're crossing boundaries that you shouldn't be crossing. So instead of pretending that you're doing a nice thing and you're having an old nice table and you're serving them food, send them out here and we'll cross those boundaries in a very real way, and you don't have to bother with your charade, right? So the idea is that's the din of Sodom, which is of course corrupt din. That's din that absolutely has no giving. That's din that says that's, you know, obviously Yitzchak he's the av of din, but he can't be that type of din. Yitzchak has to be the din of laughter, the din of judgment in the sense of balance. And in order to achieve this balance, in order to achieve that balance, we have to go from Avram to Yitzchak, and Avram to Yitzchak in a way of water to fire, chesed to din. And when that fire comes, the fire of the Akedah, it has such a profound impact on both Avram and Yitzchak that Yitzchak really disappears from the scene for almost an entire parsha. It says that Avram himself went back. It doesn't even say that Yitzchak came down. Yitzchak is, and that's a whole different discussion of what happened to Yitzchak. But the idea is that Yitzchak represents the laughter that represents the ability to hold a worldview, but be ready at any moment to let go of it. Now, in this week's parsha, without getting into Sarah specifically, but in this week's parsha, really what's happening is it's a transition parsha that is in between Avram and Yitzchak. So what happens is that the time of Avram, the Av, that's Avram and Yitzchak. So what happens is now Avram changes, he shifts gears tremendously in this parsha. First of all, in this parsha we are told that he wrote Esh Eschayil as a eulogy for Sarah. This is the first time that we find Avram really dealing with his marriage in a way that is familiar to us. Before this, it was like this. We're not. It's not a judgment issue. We can't really relate to the Avos on any level. But with Esh Eschayil, it's something that at least it rings a bell about the way we picture a relationship should be. It's something we can at least relate to. And you see that Avram, and that's a tremendous shift. When Avram went down to Mitzrayim, it was very, very practical. He told Sarah, right? He recognized first that.
Say that every time they went someplace, they pulled the string, they only got into trouble twice.
Yeah, this is so it was a very kind of a utilitarian way, at least the way it's described to us. Again, I'm not suggesting in any way that this is the the full explanation of what Avram and Sarah's relationship was. But certainly the way that it's told to us in the Torah is very, very utilitarian. We're going out to this place. They're going to think that if you're my wife, it's going to be a problem. Say you're my sister and so on. And it's like, and I'm going to get money from it. Remember, we talked about that. I'm going to make money out of it when we go down to Mitzrayim because you're my sister and they're going to, and they'll give me a lot of gifts and so on. So it's very, here suddenly there's a shift to something that's much more personal in a sense with the Eishes Chayil. And then Avram, of course, gets involved in marrying off Yitzchak. And he gets, it's almost like he gets involved now in transitioning. Up until now, he's been building Yitzchak to the point where Yitzchak can be a person that can be the Av of Din, but in a healthy way, right? The Av of Din, but in a balanced way. The Av of Din who can laugh, right? Whose name represents laughter, the ability to let go of a worldview at any moment and embrace the new worldview that has to be there. And now he gets involved in the Shidduch and so on, and Eliezer, and this goes this to actually, we don't have time, but to actually look at the Parsha, maybe we could do it next week a little bit, to look at the Parsha and see how each one of these pieces plays a direct role in this transition is very, very important. One thought that I'll leave you with, which I saw right over here, is, hang on a second, is like this, that when, by the Akedah, when Avram says to Eliezer and Yishmael, who are the two, you know, Narim, right, who go along with him, so Avram says, Shavu lachem po im achamor, stay here with the donkey, right? So the Maharal explains, so the Gemara says first, before the Maharal, the Gemara says, Am hadome lachamor, right? The nation that's compared to the donkey. He's talking about Yishmael. So the Maharal explains like this. The chamor is the symbol. What is chamor? A symbol for chumrius. Chamor means chomer, the physicality, right? And physicality, chamor is chumrius being. And when a person is completely intertwined in physicality and completely living in the physical world where it's all about the chumrah, so that's really avdus. That's really slavery. A person who is living in a world that is completely defined by physicality is enslaved to their physicality, right? The idea of freedom, of a free person, is somebody who is really attached much more to the idea of tzura. That's the Maharal uses the word of tzura. The word tzura is the form as opposed to the matter itself. It's the idea of the spirituality and so on and so forth. So the Maharal says anyone who is themselves a mishubad, anyone who is an eved, in a sense, is comparable to a donkey, right? Because that's what a chamor is representative of that. So in fact, so we see this kind of double way of understanding Eliezer, because Eliezer, on one hand, we know is a tzaddik; on the other hand, it's shvulach empo and machamor, right? He's staying with the chamor. So that's this week's parsha, I believe, starts to work out that the same way that Avram was working out the balance between chesed and din, right, to produce the Yitzchak. So there's also we're being taught that there's another element that has to be worked out, and it's really wrapped up in the same idea that a person, what does it mean holding on to a view of reality and being ready to change it? If you hold on to a view of reality, meaning physical reality, and you're not able to change it, so you're enslaved to that reality. You're a chamor, you're an eved, right? And you have to be able to get past that. Eliezer, in our parsha, struggles very much with his picture of reality and letting go of it, because his picture of reality is that he wants Yitzchak for his daughter. And he holds on to it so much that, you know, he's saying, well, what if they won't want to come? And you know, what if she won't want to go with me? And he's like, he's kind of arguing, and the Mefarshim explained to us, because he had this picture of reality. And he has to go through this process himself of readjusting his view of reality in order to find, and it's so appropriate, in order to find the shidduch for Yitzchak, whose laughter, who represents the ability to let go of a view of reality and replace it with the one that is now more real. And so that's really what this week's parsha is about, kind of applying the principles that were the seeds that were planted by Avram's journey of Lech Lecha, of developing himself as the Av Aram, who moves from Chesed all the way to Din to be able to produce a Yitzchak who is Din but Tzchok at the same time, din on the deepest level, din on the level not of the not on the destructive level, not on the level of limitations where you do horrible things to people, but din on the level of judgment, of being able to be balanced and being able to be balanced in a way that doesn't hold on to only that way, but be able to go with whatever is happening, right? Obviously on a high level. So now in this week's parsha, that's really being worked out. How is it being worked out? Sarah passes and Avram has to deal with that. He has to deal with actually fulfilling part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nevuah of acquiring part of Eretz Yisrael, and he has to bargain. He's suddenly very much in the real world dealing with exactly this. Real situations that have worldviews that could easily allow a person to become stuck and having to become unstuck and be able to be balanced. And so that, I believe, if you look at Chayei Sarah with that light, you can start to understand a lot of the stories and a lot of the nuances of Chayei Sarah. Okay, I'll take some questions. Yes?
I noticed as we're talking about Avram being chesed and Yitzchak being din, that Sarah is both. Sarah is a balas chesed. We know that. She's Avram's partner. She's a balas chesed. And yet, every now and then, she comes down on din.
Right.
So Yitzchak is much more his mother's son in response.
Sure. I mean, that, you could say that. Although we don't know, as we only have a few instances of Sarah. We don't see the.
But
sure. Yeah, absolutely. I want to say, just by the way, as a takeaway, something that's just, I think, incredibly important for us to learn in our own lives is like this balance idea is like super important, because that you know, you could be a very, very religious Jew and keep all the mitzvahs that you possibly can keep and so on, but if you have a particular worldview that's harmful to yourself or to others, or right, to ourselves or others, so even if it seems, you know, sometimes people have a worldview that seems to be completely consistent with halacha and completely consistent with Torah, but in fact it's destructive. Right, it's that I'm not making this up. The Gemara says that Torah itself can be the most, it's Eitz Chaim, the Torah, but also Torah can be Samim Avos. It can be a terrible thing, right? So we've mentioned many times, you could have two guys sitting and learning full time, and one guy sitting and learning full time because it truly brings him simcha. He believes that he's doing something extremely important. He's connecting to Kadosh Baruch Hu. He's growing from it. And the other person is sitting and learning because that's what everyone else is doing, and actually he feels trapped by it, and he's doing it, and he's constantly working on himself to learn harder so that he could attract more attention and be known as an Eloi and be known as a, and so on. So he's really enslaved to his worldview, to his view of reality. On the outside, it might look like both of them are amazing. You might even think that the person who's not doing so well is really doing better, because he might be more driven to do all sorts of things that make him seem in other people's eyes like he's a hero. He's sitting and learning. He's doing all those wonderful things. But if it's not coming from a view of reality. Now, what's a good raya? How would you be able to know such a thing? So it's a simple thing. When a person who's sitting and learning is forced to go out into the world and earn a living, how do they react? So if they react by being bitter about it, and by being angry, and I can't believe this happened to me, and I put in all those years of learning, and now I have to go take a J-O-B, right? So if that's the reaction to it, so that's not a person who understands Yitzchak. That's not a person who's in balance. That's not a person who's able to react to the situation, to let go of one worldview and have it replaced by other. There's no, I mean, as a matter of fact, a certain Rav in Muncie, I don't know if he wants his name mentioned, told me recently that he's been dealing with a number of these cases. He says that he believes if he could, he would institute in Klal Yisrael that they should read the ksuba in English at the chuppah, so that the chassanim should understand that they're actually undertaking the achrayas to provide for their wives, right? So if a person is in a matzav where they're able to learn, they're being supported, or whatever it is, or they have, so wonderful, beautiful, chas v'shalom taking away from that. But what happens when it runs out, or a person is no longer able to? So how do they react to it? The gedolim in Europe who were promised, there are a number of stories, the gedolim in Europe who were promised, you know, pensions by their fathers-in-law, and then suddenly after a year or so the money ran out and they weren't able to be supported. Do you think they walked around upset that their father-in-law, how could you do this to me, and upset that suddenly their lot in life was changed, that they, you know, they, you know why they stayed gedolim? They stayed gedolim because it didn't mean, so okay, so they opened the store, the Chafetz Chaim had a store, so, you know, his wife helped him and spent most of the time, but when he had to cover the store, he covered the store. He was a human being who recognized, okay, we have to make a living, we have to do these things, and that's part of life. And so if my worldview was one one way, hey, that was good for then. But now a new thing has happened, and now I have to adjust it. So that's, I think, for our own lives, I think I just to speak for myself, that the ability to be able to not be stuck in a worldview. Obviously, we want to be within the Dalai Lama's of halacha, but not to be stuck in a worldview that says this is the way it has to be. Be able to be ready at any moment that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends us a new event that changes the worldview, and we have no choice. So a good barometer is, how do we deal with that? Are we upset? Are we angry? Are we stuck and having a really hard time? Or are we able to say, we're adjusting?
It's a very good example, because he had to support himself, he wrote Spurs.
Right, that's right, absolutely,
and
yes.
Why does the Maharal compare with Homer and Surah? Why is the Surah considered the goof and the Homer considered...
No, the Homer is the goof. And the tzura is the form. Chomer is the physicality.
Tzura is the external.
No. Chomer.
It's the shape.
Right, the shape. But the shape doesn't mean external only. That's on the simple level. It's the form. But form means the higher essence of
the goal of what it's.
The higher essence of it, exactly.
Like the Plato form.
Yeah, you could say it that way.
Example of how.
It's hard because we can't think of. I mentioned the story before. I once took a. I was very close with Reb Simcha Wasserman Zatzal.
Homer, even though it's the word Homer, which
right.
Means Homeriut, but on the other hand, because it's inside, if you think of that as being the essence.
Right, but it's not. It's not.
So the word Chomer is used to, a strict. I'm not sure about
the relationship of Chomer and Chomer, but. Take care, have a good Shabbos. But just to say, this was one story. I think it's a good story, those who want to hear it. Reb Simcha Wasserman, I was very close to him. I was zocher to be very close to him. I named my youngest son after him. And I once had the opportunity, I'm sure I've told this story before, but I once had the opportunity to bring a group of Talmidim to sit with him on a Shabbos afternoon and ask him questions. And I brought a group of people, Talmidim, who have a lot of questions. And I prepped them. I told them this is a real gadol. You could ask him any question. When we got there, not one of them could think of any questions that they had to ask him. And he was not a frightening looking person at all. He was the friendliest, tremendous hadras panim. So he was like kibitzing them. Oh, yeah, I have any questions? No questions, no questions. So finally, one of them says, okay, I have a question, Rabbi. He says, how come, why are you not allowed to shave? Why are you not allowed to shave with a razor? So like everybody just like laughed, because after like 20 minutes of prodding, like that's the question that you have about Judaism. Like that's really funny. So Reb Simcha, he just like smiled, and then he thought about it. He took the question very seriously. And he said an answer that I thought was very profound and really threw this guy for a loop, because he was expecting things like, he says, well, first of all, you probably know that it says in the Torah you're not allowed to shave with a razor, and that's the basic reason why not. So the guy says, yeah, well, I know that. So he says, well, on a deeper level, he says there are two things in the world. There's Chomer and Tzura. There's matter and there's form, right? We, as human beings, can only conceive of matter that has some sort of form, right? We can conceive of matter that has different forms. We can conceive of liquid can turn into a gas, liquid can turn into a solid. We can change the form that it takes, but we can't, whatever we think of is matter, right? We can't think of something that's not matter. And so he says, certainly you cannot think on the level of just tzura, of just form. He says, but there is an idea that the essence of matter is the form that it takes. Meaning the form isn't just about the form physically, because physical is still rooted in Chomer, but it's the tzura is about the essence of it, what it represents on a deeper level. And he says there's such a thing as tzura without Chomer that we can't access with our imagination. So he says many mitzvos that we don't understand, that don't seem to make sense, or aren't so easy to access the reasons, he says it's because those mitzvos somehow directly affect the tzura, they directly affect the essence of the matter in a way that we can't necessarily recognize because we can't think of it in that level. So he says, so shaving with a razor, he says on a certain level, that affects the tzura of who you are. Not the tzura that we mean, like how you're going to look in the mirror, but the tzura meaning the essence of your who you are, the essence of your guf. So therefore, the Torah gives you this mitzvah so that you can impact on your tzura on a level that's beyond Chomer. That's a hard idea, the hard concept to understand, but in essence, in modern physics, it's not as hard to understand because all physicality really is nothingness, right?
So it has an effect
Right. Right. But what he was saying is that we can't access that level of understanding. So he's saying, so some mitzvos, like I guess maybe more mitzvos that are chukim, somehow affect the tzura without the chomer. So we live in a world of chumrias, we live in a world of chomer, so we're looking around, how does this work, what is it, right? Everyone wants to find some sort of special disease that happens if you wear shatnas, right? There, right? I always hear people talking about that, right? I don't think that's really so true, because if it was true,
no,
probably,
Americans,
right?
Colonials were
right.
Wore a material called Lindsay Wilson.
Right, and so if it was true, probably people, we would know about it right now, right? So, why are they looking for that? Because you want to try to understand the mitzvah in the world of chumrias, in the world of chomer. But if you just, so you have to, it requires a certain degree of suspension of understanding to say this. But once you recognize that there are things, there's a whole world out there that we don't understand, the world of ruchnias, the world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the world of creation that we don't have access to in the physicality that we live in. So to say that the physical affects the spiritual, we say that all the time, right? What we do here counts. I mean, that's what this whole idea here is, what we're learning from Aravino, that it actually counts. So if it really counts, then there could be a mitzvah that's directly affecting the tzura, the essence of it, beyond it. And we can't really understand it any more than saying that. We can't say any more than that. That's what he was saying.
I'm going to ask you a question. It doesn't drive me up the wall, but something I wonder about, okay, from a couple of weeks ago, for the interplechlecha, the bris, which is so very important, why is it designed to be only on a man's body? Why isn't a woman in the sign of the bris?
I think to understand that, really, there's a number of levels to that question. On the simplest level, the reason for a bris, there's so many levels, but on the simplest level, the reason for a bris is, you could do anything for a bris. You could,
the reason for a bris is to mark a yid as a yid. Excuse me!
One second. You could mark in many different ways.
Right.
You could have funny looking tattoos on your shoulder, you could have nose rings, there's many different things that a person could do, branding, right? As we see, just look out on the street today, right? One second. So you have to understand why it is this mark that marks a male as a yid, and not just some random, if it was just some random mark, so then, it was only for men, so that would be right. So clearly, this has to do with being male, right? It clearly has to do with being male. So being male means also works on many, many levels. But on the simplest physical level, in order for a male not to be too caught up in chumrius, is exactly really what we're talking about. In order for a male not to be too caught up in chumrius, so the bris milah, I mean, the Sfarim say, the Gemara says that the bris milah actually takes away a certain degree of the of klipa, but I think even a certain degree of the pleasure that's involved, and allows for a male to be able to recognize that it can be used for a higher level, that the pleasure involved can be used for a higher level, that it's not stuck on the chomer level.
But why does
right?
the woman need a sign?
So, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu created men and women differently, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's not the sign. So you're asking about the sign, but the Svarim, the Gemara and the Chazal, when they talk about it, they don't talk about it as a sign.
This comes back again to the women are on a higher level, the Rechnis.
I don't buy into that so much. Nothing personal, but I'll tell you why I don't buy into it so much. I don't buy into it because, and this is unorthodox, but I'm like right in the middle. I don't buy into it so much because it's a hint of apologetica. Another right, exactly. I prefer to think of it that men and women are different, right? And so there are different. Just as there are different physicality for men and women, there's also different spirituality for men and women. And it's not about one necessarily being on a higher level or a lower level, but rather being just being completely different. So the certain spiritual aspects that appeal or that are connected to a male are just because of the nature of the way a male was created, and certain spiritual things, spiritual ideas that are specifically for women, because of the way a woman was created. So it's not about necessarily that women are on a higher madriga, although in some areas they could be, right? But that's not the point here. The point there isn't about a higher madriga. The point is that women were created with a different capacity for dealing with chomer, for dealing with reality. I think in general, women deal with reality overall in a much more healthy way than men, right? You can't generalize because you'll find 20 men that will disprove me and 20 women that will disprove me. But the idea is that since a woman, or let's not talk about a woman, but a femaleness in the universe represents the idea of nurturing, the idea of allowing potential to actually become realized, right? That's just as in creation of a child. The woman is the one who gives the hard work and the nurturing that is required to bring a child into the world, whereas a male is not focused on that so much. So that really reflects tremendously. I mean, I think that if you look around at statistics, and I'm talking off the cuff here, I haven't studied it, but I would imagine that if you would do a statistical study on, let's say, impetuousness in business, right? I'm willing to bet that you would find that men are far more impetuous than women, because they don't have the same grip on reality that women do. And overall, you'll find exceptions, but overall, that's the way it is. And you know, it's so interesting. There are many studies that show very, very big differences between men and women on many different levels. And the people who are studying it have a very hard time. Whenever they write about it, they're always apologizing for the findings. Matter of fact, recently I saw.
Very sarcastic about the Time cover of Men and Women the Difference.
Right.
Yeah, do what it was for.
Right. Recently, I saw a piece about a study that was done on the reaction, the different reaction between men and women when they're confronted with absolute evidence that they were wrong. Right. So a male, when a male is shown completely that they were wrong, the reaction of a male is usually to say, like, whoa. You know, I guess I was wrong, you know, and to kind of like, it might take them a while to see it, but once they see it and they see the evidence and they weigh it and it makes sense, okay, I was wrong. A woman will get angry. Yeah, yeah. A woman will get angry and it will take them time. Exactly, emotional and angry, and they can't just say like, oh, I was wrong, I apologize. They need time to process the fact that they were wrong and to internalize it. And then, you know, by the next day, they're usually able to move on as well. It's just a longer process in that area. So the woman who wrote the article was very upset. She did the experiment many times, but unfortunately, every single time she did the experiment, the results were exactly the same, and she tried various different ways. And the fact of the matter is, this is something that is actually true overall of the difference between men and women. So I think that's the shot over here.
Thing and see how upset he would get and see how upset she was.
Right.
Well, you know.
So I think that's the fundamental answer to your question is basically that you have to understand when you look at the bris just as a sign and you just stop right there, so then there's a question. But the bris is much more than that. In other words, the bris is an external sign that really represents on its deepest level the maleness, males dealing with their relationship to reality and their relationship to chomer.
And a woman doesn't.
A woman is created without the need for an external, addition or subtraction, however you look at it, an external thing that will allow her to, she doesn't need that adjustment.